Okay, I have 8 o'clock on my clock now, so I can begin just in time. So, I always like to get inspired by the questions which I have asked in the evening time. And one of those questions last night was, Ajahn Brahm, can you please give a deeper talk on meditation? Just like I do to the monks on a Wednesday night. So that's a very secret teachings, only for the initiates. But you asked for it, so you're going to get it. But I'm not going to go that deep, but who knows, see how the talk unfolds. One interesting fact I will share with you, that very often that I have resolved to give a deep talk on Dhamma, but it doesn't come out deep. And I often reflected, why is that the case, when my intention was one thing and the talk was not really that deep? And I found out through experience that it's really depending upon the audience. There is an interaction always between the speaker and the audience. I do keep eye contact with you when I'm talking, but it's even deeper than that. That if I find, even subconsciously, that the talk is too profound for the people listening, then automatically I cannot stop it. It just goes to a more easily comprehensible level. So I can only give a deep talk if you let me. And if you don't, it never happens. It's very fascinating that I'm not in control of the talks. They come out according to the needs, requirements of the audience. It is an interaction. It's a very interesting thing, because I've been giving talks for such a long time and to many different audiences, and this is just what happens. You cannot just decide to give a deep talk. You may try, and if it happens, that's a feather in your cap. You're an audience which is ready for it. But anyway, one of the things you asked me to talk about was the dependent origination, but I'm going to start with something which is far more interesting than dependent origination. It is connected to it. Dependent origination is just basically knowing what causes the things we experience in life. And it also links to the other question which was asked yesterday, last night, what is Yoni Samani Sikara, the work of the mind which goes and finds the causes of things. Not so much as what is happening, but why it's happening. And if you know the cause, you don't just focus on the symptoms, but you focus on the causes, then you can actually take away the cause and the effect vanishes. It's one of the reasons why, instead of trying to stop the thinking in meditation, bring it back, it goes off again, bring it back, goes off again, bring it back again. That's just looking at the symptoms of a restless mind, thinking. And you can think about anything. There's no end to stuff you can think about. And don't ever assume that if you think it through and it's all done, then you can be calm and quiet. Thinking is endless. But we find the causes, the origin, why we think. And I've pointed a few things out there. The restlessness, the lack of contentment, even sometimes the fear of quietness, not being used to stillness, sometimes even not knowing what it is. And so because of that fear, because of that sometimes seeking for pleasure called boredom, then sometimes that we don't allow the stillness to last long enough. And another way of seeing that is that peaceometer. How peaceful is your mind? The thoughts are like the waves on the surface of the lake, and just trying to pat the waves down doesn't get you anywhere. Instead, what's agitating the lake. What's the cause of it? Wanting, doing something, that is causing the agitation. So when you find out the cause, then it's very easy to let go of the cause, and then the thinking stops. The same which I was saying with jhanas. You know, don't aim for jhanas, aim for the causes. We put the causes in place, and of course the result happens. And the cause is just letting go, relaxing, not wanting anything in the whole world, just being so happy. Look, you're in jhana grove. You get beautiful breakfast and lunch. Okay, I apologize for not having any dinner, but you know, this is pretty good. Imagine all the other people today. It's Tuesday. The holiday period's over. They're all having to go to work today. And you don't have to do anything. So just imagine, reflect on how lucky you are. Imagine what it's like going to work, getting stuck in the traffic. Just, you know, having to dress up in the morning, girls having to put makeup on because that's what you have to do to go to work. It should be like the guys. The guys don't even need to shave these days. So, girls, you don't need to shave either. And then when you get there, there's all these emails you have to answer. Your boss demands something done in an impossible time. And, oh, you just, it's so difficult all day. And by lunchtime, you're stressed out. And you go and find some lunch. There's a big queue at the sandwich bar. And, oh, it's just so difficult. And you have to go back to work again. And people are calling you up to complain. And, oh, yeah. You have nothing to do today. Oh, what bliss. Anything like jhanas or even a beautiful breath, that's extra. That's gravy. You've already got the main course. Nothing doing. Ah. So, when you don't want anything, of course, and you're not expecting anything, you're not demanding anything, then it's so easy to be peaceful. And you're putting the causes in for the deep meditations. But there is another cause which I wanted to talk about, because this is a type of dependent origination, which many people, when they're reading through the suttas, think, wow, this is interesting, because it's a cause and effect relationship. And I remember Bhikkhu Bodhi did a little monograph on it. He called it transcendental dependent origination. I don't know why he called it that, just to give it some different name. But it is another causal sequence, A leads to B leads to C leads to D leads to E, which is fascinating because it all starts from the unlikeliest place of suffering as a cause for enlightenment. And so many of you can say, yeah, I've ticked that box, I've done that stage. And what it means, and you can see this, so many people, they come to Buddhism, they come to learn meditation because they've got problems. It's called suffering. And just on so many people, they go on the YouTube channel, not because they're interested in Buddhism, because they're desperate to find some solution to the problems of their life. It could be a marriage breakup, it could be depression, lack of self-esteem, all sorts of stuff, where people first come to the Dhamma because I need some help. And even modern psychology, it's always a response to suffering in life. No one goes to see a psychologist if you're in your right mind. That was a newspaper editor, Randolph Hearst, you know, died a long time ago. Newspaper owner in California, made his fortune years ago. He said anyone who goes to see a psychiatrist needs their head examined. It was a nice pun, play on words. But the reason they go there is because they're in trouble. And this is one of the problems actually with Buddhism in Thailand now. Because people told me, why do you want to go and see a monk? If you want to go and see a monk, it must mean you have some psychological troubles. And so you go into a monastery and you're already stigmatized as being a little bit mentally unstable. Or if it's not mental instability, it's because of social problems. So any woman who goes into a temple to talk to a monk means they're having trouble with their marriage, which is another stigma. But it is true, in a sense, a lot of people, they come to talk to you because they've got problems. And what happens is you hear some of these teachings of Buddhism and you get inspired by the answers. There is something there which says, this teaching understands what it's like to live as a human being with a mind and with a body which gets old and old and old, in a world where you don't get what you want, in a world where you strive, strive, strive and get frustrated, in a world where many people respond to frustration with anger, with a desperate attempt to use force of will to try and get what they think they need. And so that particular world is very well explained in Buddhism. So much so, there's many psychologists coming here saying that, you know, that what they hear from Buddhism, what they learn from Buddhist monks, is what they find practical in their usual daily life with their clients. So it gives you an inspiration that there's something in these teachings which understands what's happening and also understands the end of suffering, how to get out of it. It is that inspiration which gives you a type of joy which is called pasada. It's okay, so you've got to be joyful now because that's what your name means. It's actually sampasada. So with this joy. And it's a Pali word which is halfway between, that's actually a combination, not between, a combination of inspiration and this uplift, this energy, this beginnings of joy. You get inspired. And that is just coming from the most unlikeliest of sources, you know, the realizing suffering, but there is a way out. Yay! So that sense of joy and inspiration is an important part of getting success in meditation. It's one of those basic causes. It's very hard to get deep meditation when you're depressed. It's very hard to get deep meditation when you're upset that some selfish, greedy idiot took the last piece of toast. There's no more bread. You're killing your chances of meditation with those negativity. But instead, you can use inspiration. Oh, wonderful, they had a piece of toast, and I'm so happy that they had it and I didn't. May you enjoy that piece of toast out of loving kindness, out of mudita, sympathetic joy. I'm so joyful that you got it and I don't need to have it. So you can do that. And that's one of our trainings as monks. And it's, you know, basic psychology. You get much more happiness giving a piece of toast to somebody else than eating it yourself. So it's getting some inspiration up. But if you don't have inspiration, then it's so difficult to even to get started in meditation, which is one of the reasons why we give talks, to try and inspire you, uplift you. So after the meditation, after the teaching session, sometimes these talks really hit the spot and you get so inspired. It's not really such important that what you actually said, but where it comes from, the inspiration, the uplift. And afterwards, you sit down, you just want to meditate. Wow, this is so great. And you get into these amazing meditations when you start with inspiration. And it's my experience every now and again, you know, Ajahn Chah would give incredible talks. And when they really hit the sweet spot, it was so easy to meditate afterwards. You sit there, wow, this is great, this is so easy. It's as if that inspiration, that joy, just blew away all of those hindrances. You weren't restless, you weren't negative, you were just, wow, this is great stuff. So inspiration is to be cultivated. Don't have a negative, cynical mind. Yeah, these Buddhists, they're not real meditators. They don't know what they're really doing. But any cynicism like that, you know, you're taking a beautiful inspiration and you're putting it down. somebody comes along and they said they've got nimitters, or they've got this, like I read out in the questions, they say, oh, I've got this beautiful nimitter, what do I do next? And you think, yeah, they haven't got nimitters, they're just making it up. And you're always doubting people's success. Because why? Because you haven't got any nimitters at all. That's the only reason why. But if you can celebrate other people's happiness and success, that's called mudita. And that just is free joy. You don't do anything. Other people do the work. They sit for hours. You can see a stupid smile on their face. Yeah, wonderful, great. I'm so happy that, you know, you're getting some meditation. Free inspiration. So don't get into Western cynicism or negativity when you've got happiness there for the taking for free. Just within hand's reach, take it and get inspired and then meditate. Or you can create your own inspiration. Your own inspiration is just, you know, just starting to think about, you know, this beautiful retreat center, where it came from. Think of all the amazing generosity which people did to build this place. And I always like mentioning, because the monk responsible returned from Sydney yesterday. You on this side of the meditation hall, the bamboo flooring which you're sitting on was laid by monks. And the reason was, we were going to have our opening ceremony. And the builder promised it would be finished in time. And I said, are you sure? And they said, are you doubting me? Are you questioning my professionalism? No, sorry. And of course, I knew what would happen. It wasn't finished in time. Most things were, but this floor was a big hole here and just concrete. They couldn't finish in time. So, what happened? When the builders went home in the afternoon, that's when the monks came out to work. And they, ceremony was started, 7 o'clock, 8, 9 o'clock in the morning? And those monks were, I think, laying these things. They finished about 4 a.m. They worked through the night, laying the bamboo flooring you're sitting on right now in order to make it ready for the ceremony and the first Easter retreat, which happened as soon as the ceremony was complete. So remember what you're sitting on. These monks here, they don't just sit in there and sleep all day. They don't even sleep all night. They're out there. And what they're doing it for? Not for themselves, for you. Now, when you feel like that, that whoa gets you inspired. Wow, this is amazing stuff. And that inspiration. I hope you're getting some, because I get it when I tell these stories. All that other stuff which, you know, happened in the life of these monasteries. You know, just ordaining bhikkhunis. The reason why these people are here. Should we, shouldn't we? Should we, shouldn't we? And all the my so-called friends in China were trying anything possible to try and stop it. And I remembered that Ajahn Bhumari was the point person here. And it was that touch and go, I mean really that touch and go, that I was just coming back from England giving some teachings there. And Ajahn Bhumari met me at the airport. Should we, shouldn't we? Because we were going to do it that night. Straight off the plane. And we discussed it on the way from Perth Airport to here. What do you reckon? Should we? Should we not? Should we? It was that, it really was that touch and go. And then, let's do it. Let's go for it. Of course, you know that happened because you guys are here. So we did it. Who cares? It's the right thing to do. So we did it. Yeah. You know, that's inspirational. You know, even for me, you know, you just think about that. Wow, we actually did it. And it was not easy. That's inspirational. And I got nothing out of this. Just more headaches. Lots more headaches. More headaches. No, I wasn't looking at this. Yes, I was. So those are the things which really inspire you. And think about those inspirations, all the stuff which you have done. Lots of you have given so much, you know, to make this thing work. You can't just do these things by yourself. Build monasteries, build retreat centers. You know, sometimes, you know, you give us the money and we do the slave labor. But no, we enjoy doing stuff like that. In fact, I love working, but you don't let me. The last time, about a year ago, I was up on the roof, you know, of this complex here, fixing, you know, something, just screwing the roof sheets off, and the previous caretaker took photos of me. Oh, I really got into trouble for that. Ajahn Brahm, you must not go on the roof. You might fall off. Yeah, so what, you fall off. But then you won't be able to teach us. I'll be teaching you the lesson of impermanence. And some of the monks, you know what they said? Ajahn Brahm, you must not go up on the roof. The rafters aren't strong enough. They were strong enough. I didn't fall through. But anyway, it gives you lots of inspiration to see people working together and helping out and no one taking advantage of anybody else. And so that's brilliant. And I remember those things, as hopefully you do. Great acts of kindness and sacrifice. And those types of giving, letting go. Great acts of charity, kindness, compassion. Those are the things which lift you up. Inspiration. Because you see, something needs to be done. There's some suffering there. Something needs to be fixed up. So you do it. And you get this beautiful inspiration, which is an important part of meditation. If you see someone here, they're meditating hour after hour and they miss their lunch, don't sort of criticize them and think they're just really up themselves. Who do they think they are? Do they think they're the Buddha? No, just get inspiration. Let inspiration, wow, it's working. Someone's actually meditating so beautifully. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Oh, that just gives me so much happiness and joy. And in fact, and the question last night, they said, now, why did I do my 6-month retreat? What did I get out of it? It didn't matter what I get out of it. A lot of people got so inspired. You can do that. You can just spend 6 months not talking to any living being. It's not just 9 days noble silence. It's 6 days real noble silence. So 6 months. Sorry. That's lovely. So easy to do. And that inspired people. So they said sometimes that's the best Dhamma talk I ever gave. Not in words. Because words, you can get words anywhere. But actions, see it actually happening. That's, or like this story, I love telling this story. I always go off the track, but these stories come up and they're really inspiring. What inspired me, and inspired many other people. There was a monk, he was a Vietnamese monk. I won't say who, because it's not fair to tell who it is. This Vietnamese monk was teaching a meditation retreat in Sydney, a 9-day one, just like we do here. Only started off meditating, just... And then he was going to give a talk at 8 o'clock afterwards, the first night, Friday night. It's one of the Friday to Sunday retreats. And after finishing the meditation, everybody sort of opened their eyes, waiting for the talk. But the monk was still meditating. He carried on sitting there. 8:30, still meditating, supposed to be giving a talk. 9 o'clock, still meditating. 9:30. And what did people do? They all went to bed. No, they weren't going to wait for the monk to get out of meditation. It's a good job they did go to bed, because when they got up in the morning, he was still there, sitting there, meditating. He meditated there for 8 days straight without moving. Didn't go to the toilet, didn't take any water, didn't move, not in a fraction. He was sitting there just like a Buddha statue for 8 days and nights, continuous. And when he came out of his meditation, apparently he apologized to everybody, "I'm so sorry. You know, I got into deep meditation, I just, you know, couldn't come out. So I'm terribly sorry, I never gave you any teachings." And they said, "No, that was the most amazing, inspiring thing we could actually witness, that monks can actually do that these days. They can actually sit still for 8 days solid. Wow, that's so inspiring. Thank you so much. That's all the Dhamma talk we need. That's unforgettable. The information you get from books or from YouTube, but actually to see it, you know, and know it's real, that is really inspiring. So all this inspiration, that's important. And once you get inspired, you get all this joy coming up. It's called piti, joy. And this is from dukkha to sampasadana to piti. These are three stages in what Bhikkhu Bodhi coined transcendental dependent origination. One thing leading to another to another. And once you get this piti coming up, the next stage, which happens automatically, is don't say, oh, I've got piti now, let's go to the next stage. You can't help it. It just happens. It's automatic. The next stage is you get so tranquil. Your body becomes still. No aches and pains in it. When you're enjoying yourself, you don't feel pain or aches anywhere in the body. You know the old phenomena that people are playing contact sport like rugby or football and they break their leg and they still carry on playing and they can't even feel the pain. They're enjoying, they're so absorbed in the game they can't even feel any pain. Or just like you, maybe you haven't broken your leg but you're watching a movie and you want to go to the toilet and you can't even feel it. You can't feel the pressure in your bladder. Or your leg's gone to sleep and you can't even feel it. Because you're watching the movie and it's enjoyable. And then afterwards, oh, once the movie's finished, oh, my leg's gone to sleep. Oh, I really need to go to the loo. Oh, you know, I can feel the pain now. But when you're enjoying something, you've got piti. All of those irritations which make the body move are gone. Because you have really strong joy. That's one of the reasons why in hospitals to alleviate pain there should be much more fun. The doctors should all go into their consultations wearing red noses, just like Patch Adams used to do. Because that joy takes away a lot of pain. And for meditators, once you get some joy coming up, you can't even cough. It's gone. One of my experiences, long time since I said this experience here, I was a student, and this was after Cambridge. I went up to Durham University. The main reason I went to Durham University, because my girlfriend was up there. I wasn't born a monk. So stupid reasons. Anyway, I was up there. It's a really cold part of the world up in the north of England. And so I got a cold, a really bad flu. And I didn't go to the lectures that morning. I stayed in this house, you know, with supposed to be a lot of other students there. They were all at their lectures. I was the only one in, feeling terrible. You know, the snot coming out of your nose, watering eyes, coughing. And just feeling just, you know, just that close to death. In fact, sometimes, you know, that if you had a choice, you know, you may have taken it. But anyway, I was feeling so terrible. You know what it's like when you have flu? Ugh, it's a terrible feeling. No energy and all this stuff. You can't really rest because stuff is coming out of your nose continuously. And it's really gross. And you try and sort of stop and then you cough. So you can, you know what it's like when you can't go to sleep at night because you're always coughing. And that's what I felt. I felt really terrible. And then somebody was banging on the door of the student house. And, go away. Get lost. But they couldn't. They kept on ringing the bell or knocking on the door. So in my pajamas, I just struggled, like crawling, staggered to the door. What do you want? And they said, we have a parcel here. A delivery for Mr. Peter Betts. That's my old name. Oh, that's me. And what is it? And it was my hi-fi system, which I'd sent up from London. You know, and in those days, that was 1972 or 3 or 72, in those days, to get music, you just couldn't use an iPhone and press a few buttons. You had to have all this big, heavy equipment. You know, the turntable, which, you know, you had to make sure it was really level and nice and stable, otherwise your vinyl records would get destroyed, would scratch. You had a big amplifier and two huge speakers, and you had to put everything together. And first of all, I had to carry it up the stairs, and oh, that was so heavy. But I put it all together and put on my first album. It took about half an hour, and when I listened to my first track of Jimi Hendrix, I was really into Jimi Hendrix when I was, even had Jimi Hendrix hairstyle and green velvet trousers. And as soon as I listened to that, I wasn't sneezing anymore. I had no cough. I had energy. And that flu never came back. It was weird. And at the time I thought, this is crazy. Now, how can actually listening to Jimi Hendrix cure the flu? If that was the case, you know, you wouldn't have to have any flu shots, just, you know, get some rock music or whatever you like. But it wasn't a case of, you know, Jimi Hendrix. All it was I was enjoying myself. I hadn't heard some music for a few weeks. And so now I was hearing it, I was really overjoyed. And that pity, that joy, made my body really comfortable, tranquil. It actually stopped the fever. So if you've got, you know, do you want to hear some Jimi Hendrix? You got a few sneezes there. Just therapeutic, you're not indulging yourself, just, you know, curing your cold. But it told me that when you have that joy, that happiness, your body does become tranquil and healthy. So if you are always restless, you can't get comfortable here, you can't get comfortable there, a lot of time it's because you're not enjoying yourself. Get some inspiration, get some joy. And then you find you can sit for hours. And once you have that tranquility of body, you don't have to worry about the body anymore. Just leave it alone. So the biggest distraction, and I say this, the biggest distraction of an itchy nose, a body which is not quite, so you've got to move it this way and that way, scratch your head, scratch your mouth, all that sort of stuff is vanished. Your body can actually disappear, because it still disappear. Ah, now you're really getting happy. Once your body is tranquil, then the mind becomes tranquil. It's kaya prasaddhi and citta prasaddhi. The tranquility of the mind and the body. All coming from inspiration, leading to joy, leading to tranquility. It's not something you do, you know the causes. And then once the body is still, and I was mentioning this, mindfulness increases, and so does happiness. Your mind becomes really happy. That's delightful breath. In anapanasati, it's breathing in, breathing out, experiencing piti and sukha. Ah, oh, this is so wonderful. Many of you say you experience peace, but is the peace nice? Is it joyful? Because once you start to notice that, yeah, it's peaceful, but how does the peace feel? It's actually quite nice. It's actually very nice. Because if you look in the right place, then you'll start to develop the happiness of peace. Just in the same way, I started off enjoying things like rock music, and then later on, you got more interested in classical music. It was more refined. As a young man, I thought, boring. You know, there's no beat to it. You know, it's not loud enough. You know, but then you really got into it later on, because it was more refined. It was as if my ears and my brain could appreciate finer things in life. And then that's like the peace which we experience first in meditation you may think it's boring. But after experiencing it longer and longer, it becomes incredibly wonderful. It's like your palate begins to develop so you can taste finer foods and enjoy them. This is your mind develops so you can appreciate the joy and the bliss of what you once thought was boring, peace. Your mind starts to enjoy happiness. And the next part of this dependent origination was a real big one for me, because that just reinforced what my teacher was saying, how I understood, but something inside of me was resisting it. But this actually convinced me it's from the happiness that is where the mind gets samadhi, gets still. This is one of the first phrases I learned in Pali, Sukhino Chittang Samadhiyati, the happy mind becomes still. Not the negative mind, not the angry mind, not the depressed mind, but the happy mind becomes still and enters the deep meditations. Happiness is an important ingredient. Not fear, not aversion, not longing for jhanas, happiness. So when you create a happy mind, a joyful mind, an inspired mind, that is one of the most crucial ingredients and causes to get a jhana. So that is why I try my hardest to give you joy. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Messing around with you. Telling jokes. Trying to inspire you. Making it comfortable for you. Trying to get nice food for you. So you do get joy coming up. Wow. And you find now it's easy to meditate. So, for real big joy, you get big stillness. So don't ever be afraid of joy. Don't ever think something is going wrong. I'm enjoying this. Don't ever think, no, real meditators, we have to go through pain. One of my friends, fellow monks, again, I don't want to tell you his name, but you know, he's over in England now, that's what I'm going to say. That he decided to sit all night, enduring whatever pain came. I admire his endurance. But even though I admire his endurance, his stupidity was much greater than his endurance. Because he managed to sit all night without moving, even though he had great pain in his knees. And in the morning, we had to take him to the hospital, where he had a double knee reconstruction. That's absolutely crazy stuff. But still people actually get into that, just trying to push through the pain. It's nothing to do with Buddhism. We develop happiness and joy to the point we can't feel any pain. That monk who sat for 8 days, I know what he felt like. No pain at all. Just totally blissed out. No pain. He's made a bladder. I haven't gone to the toilet for 8 days. That must really hurt. No, just perfectly okay. No pain at all. He's enjoying himself to the max. So, the joy leads to the deep meditations. And I'll tell you later on more about nimittas. Some of those nimittas get so incredibly joyful. And it happened to me, and every now and again, interviews, people come up and say the same old stuff. Oh, yeah, I remember that. Yeah, that happened to me as well. And that was a time when the bliss gets so strong. I mean, really strong. That you think no human being can take so much ecstasy. And the insight comes, yes, you can. There's no limit to the ecstasy, the sheer bliss a human being can take. Sometimes you think it's intolerable. I can't take so much pleasure. It's just going to blow me apart. And then the pleasure gets more. I can't take any more pleasure. And then you find you can. What a wonderful insight that is. Because people have this idea that monks have no fun. That nuns, that's what they call nuns. None of this, none of that, no pleasure. It's not the case. You have a great time. Much more pleasure than you have. So anyway, you get that. Don't be afraid of pleasure in meditation, especially that beautiful pleasure which comes from the mind. And that really blows you apart. And you will get so incredibly still. Samadhi. And so what? You get samadhi. When you get into these deep meditations, what you're experiencing is like you've never seen before. You're getting data which is inaccessible to other people. Number one, in the first jhana, your body is gone. I mean really gone. You can't hear anything. Someone will go up into your ear, "Hey, dear Upat, time for lunch!" You will not hear a thing. They will knock you on the head. "Come on, get out!" And you won't feel anything. Your five senses have totally shut down. I've often told the story, I think you know, about Greg who had went into jhana and got put into Sajjar's Gardener Hospital, had defibrillators on him, didn't feel a thing until he came out of his meditation. That's a great story. But there's another person, some of you, I don't mind telling you him now. Remember old Ron's story? Yeah, he was in the army before he became a Buddhist. And he had terrible migraines. I mean, really, really strong migraines. And he told me many times, when he had a strong migraine, he was a warrant officer and he was on maneuvers in Germany or something. And they say, okay, tea break. So they'd all stop and he wouldn't have any tea. He'd go off into the nearest dark place, which was usually a barn or something, and just sit down. He didn't know what meditation was. He said, I went right inside. He used to say, right inside, until he couldn't feel the migraine anymore. And he had to do that because the pain forced him. And he said on one occasion, you know, he had a terrible migraine, they had to stop for tea break, so he told his other soldiers, you know, "You just have a cup of tea, I'm going in the barn." He went in the barn, sat down, and then a few minutes later, the order came through to move. So everyone put away their tea, it's just the exercises, and they got in their truck, their lorry, to drive off. And then one of them remembered, "Oh, we've left our sergeant back in the barn." So they went back. And these are soldiers, okay? These aren't sensitive, trained medics. They lifted up their sergeant and bunged him in the back of the truck, and he didn't feel a thing. And then a few minutes later, when he came out of his inner stillness, whatever he called it, he opened his eyes and said, "How did I get in here? I was in the barn." I said, "Oh, we just lifted you up and bunged you in here." He didn't feel a thing. He didn't hear anything. So to me, that was, wow, that was a jhana, well done. But he said, "You know, the migraines disappeared and he can't get into the jhana anymore," he said. "Sometimes he misses those migraines." He used to say, he's dead now, so I don't mind talking about him when he's dead. But, you know, that's what happens in this jhana. You can't feel anything. Your five senses have gone. Ah, isn't that nice? So what? Now you have the data, you should now understand from bare experience that even the most beautiful sights are suffering compared to having no sight at all. Even the most beautiful sounds are suffering compared to having no sound at all. The most beautiful feelings. You won't say sex, because this guy came to our monastery, he was a heroin addict. He came to try and find a positive place where he could continue just cold turkeying. and a really great guy, and it's so sad that he told me that this is what happens with addictions. Every day, 1,000 times, he has to say no to keep off the heroin. 1,000 decisions have to be no. Just one yes, and he's back on it again. And the way he put it, you can really understand just how difficult it is once you get into an addiction, how hard it is to get off. You have to say no, 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 1,000 times every day. And you just, you know, say yes once, and you're back on it. And he was doing so well, but, you know, he said yes one more time, and he got back on it again. But while he was off it, he was doing his meditation. That's always remember him coming, running to me, and saying, Ajahn Brahm, Ajahn Brahm, Ajahn Brahm. I was about to go in the car to go to Nolamar for the Friday teaching. And he said, I've got to tell you this before you go. I've got to tell you this. I've heard you say so often that the joy of having no 5 senses, of the body vanishing, is better than sex. I've heard you say that many times. But I never thought I could say it's better than heroin. Because apparently heroin is much better than sex, which is why it's so addictive. The sheer pleasure of it. But he said meditation is even better. So that's actually how incredibly powerful this is. And then you ask, why? Why is it pleasurable? It's because a whole heap of suffering has gone. Your body. So if you really want to get detached from a body and not wanting another body ever again, if you don't know what's on offer to transcend the body, then you'll always go looking for another body in your next life. Because you don't know anything else. But when you have these jhana experiences, wow, they give you data, real experience, not what you hear from a monk or from a nun, what you feel for yourself, and it blows you apart. Why didn't anyone tell me about this before? That was one of my experiences. So that's why I have to tell you about it. Even if you haven't got it yet, one day you will, and you'll understand what we're talking about, and wow. So when the Buddha said the 5 senses and this body are suffering, now you understand. It really is true, totally. So, that's only the first jhana. So, because of the second jhana, then you get the big one. I thought at first jhana you can do this, but second jhana it's so obvious. You know what happens in these deep meditations? It's so incredibly blissful. And you think, oh, it can't be bigger than this. And then it becomes much bigger. So, the bliss of the second jhana. More things disappear. And now, wow. This is more bliss. 1,000 times more bliss than the first jhana. You think, nothing can be more blissful than this, but it is. And you say, why? What's missing? And you know what's missing in the second jhana? Your will. It's gone. This thing which you cherished. This thing which people fight wars over for your personal pursuit of happiness, your free will, not to live in a dictatorship where other people control what you can do or what you can't do, your individuality, your rights to self-determination. Both of those words, self, determination should ring up red flags for Buddhists. Your will. Have you ever understood what that is? Or have you just assumed it's your personal right? Your most cherished possession, your will. So you'd fight for the death to have the freedom to do what you will. And not to be controlled by others. And that is so embedded in our wrong view that we hardly ever challenge it. And you can't really challenge it until you get into a second jhana and see the reality. There's no will there. You can't do anything. That part of you, which is choice and will, is gone. Not there. Which is one of the reasons why you can stay for a long time. There's nothing to get you out. Nothing to disturb you. It's gone. Ah, what freedom. What joy, what bliss, not to have a will. You're crazy, monk. What do you mean? And now you understand that the will, which you thought was your friend, is actually your enemy. In Buddhism, we have a personification of the will. It's called Mara. Mara, this being you read about in the suttas, is the head of the realm who wield power over other people's creation. I call him the control freak in chief. He wants to control everybody. That's why he really gets pissed off when the Buddha gets out of control. Literally, out of his control. Tried everything he could to try and control him. Fear, that was the first thing which Mara tried under the Bodhi tree. Mara's army. You know, fearful. That's what governments do. Make you afraid, and then they control you. That's what you do. You're afraid, and then you go and get controlling. You get beautiful nimittas, you're a bit afraid. Well, it's going a bit too far, too quick. So you go in and control things. You do something. We only do because we're afraid. So that's what Mara did, but the Buddha was not afraid. So then he tried the other means of controlling, sort of lust and desires, which is the other way to control people. That's why I remember, I think it's still the same, is it? Whenever they used to sell these expensive cars, mostly to men, so that is beautiful women draped over them. What's that got to do with a car? It just, that's Mara's trick, trying to entice men. It's amazing how we buy into that. But anyway, so this is Mara tried to get the Buddha to control things out of fear. And then the last trick he used was, I always call that the Bodhisattva trick. Don't get enlightened. You can do so much in the world. You can be a world-turning monarch. Sacrifice your enlightenment so you can help so many other beings. You can bring peace to this world, prosperity and harmony. I call that the Bodhisattva trick. It's trying to stop you becoming enlightened so you can help all other beings. That's what Mara tried. Offered him to be a wheel-turning monarch was the word. Bring peace, prosperity and harmony to all beings. He saw through that as well. Let go of all will and control. Have you ever noticed, actually I've known quite a few politicians and presidents, they go into the job really thinking they want to do good and help. But what happens is the best will in the world always tends to get corrupted. It's just the way of the world. When you control with the best intentions, it always turns pear-shaped. You try and control your body, and your body turns pear-shaped like mine. That's another excuse. But this is where in the second jhana, that will vanishes. And this is where you learn. This is jnana. This is from samadhi, you get jnana. This is real wisdom. Seeing it directly for yourself. Not what you're taught. You can't be taught this. In fact, for most people, it makes no sense. They say, that's ridiculous, Ajahn Brahm. They only listen to it because they respect me. But that's what will happen to you. And so the whole reason why you're practicing Buddhism, the Dhamma, is not to try and make your will smart, not to add wisdom and kindness to your will, but to realize the will is a lost cause. Bye-bye, will. It's not mine. It's suffering. It's out of control. Bye-bye, will. I'm not going to bother with you anymore. Let go. Now I hope you understand why the path is not encouraging the will. Because it realizes it's actually your enemy. It's deceived you. It is the house builder, as I said, quoting from the Theragata. That's the clearest of what that house builder is. It's your will. And once you understand that, you understand why to get into deep meditation, to see what's really happening, you have to sneak past the will, to suppress it, to let it go for long enough to understand what it really is. It's not your friend. It is your enemy. Now that is deep Dhamma. And that you cannot understand. If you think you do, you do. You're deluding yourself. It's something you actually see and turns you upside down. Wow, now what do? Nothing. I'm not going to encourage that will anymore. I'm going to sit down and just be. So this is just the insight you get even after second jhana. Let alone the other place where you hang on to, which is the sense of self. I am that which knows. These are the two last, I call them citadels of delusion. The last places where your idea of identity self hang out. One is in the will. You get past that after a second jhana. And the other one is in the knower, the mind, consciousness. And if you go deep into the jhanas, after the fourth jhana, your mind starts to disintegrate. That's the whole point of the arupas. It starts to unwind. You do literally, I mean literally, lose your mind in the arupas. It wasn't your mind anyway. So you don't say lose your mind, you lose the mind. Mindfulness starts to disappear. That's why they always say the highest place, this is what the Buddha said, sorry, the highest, strongest, purest mindfulness is in the fourth jhana. After that, consciousness starts to stop. You realize even that wasn't yours. You own nothing. You are nothing. You are a nobody, Ananda. Nobody. And to finish off with that very wonderful wise quote, which I saw on a t-shirt, nobody is perfect. I am a nobody. Therefore, I am perfect. So, if you want to be perfect, be a nobody. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Very good. I saw the interview table, so there's actually nobody on it. So I'll go back to my room. Okay, it's full this morning. Okay. Anyway, have a nice morning. Hope you're inspired. And anyway, if you didn't like that talk, you know, you asked for it, so there we go.